From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, WUWM's Marty Michelson interviews Lisa Neubauer and Brian Hagedorn, the two candidates for the open Wisconsin Supreme Court seat.
Then the Marcus Center's decision to remove the grove of chestnut trees designed by renowned landscape architect Dan Kiley caused a public outcry. We hear why that decision was made.
And this month's On That Note takes a serious turn as contributor Robert Cohen grapples with Brexit and what it might mean for touring musicians like him.
This is so much against what we stand for, what music stands for. You know, music is about collaboration, about being together, about making a voice together, about a language together, about inclusion, about love.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow, voters will go to the polls to cast ballots for Wisconsin Supreme Court. The race pits appeals judge Brian Hagedorn, who's backed by conservatives, against appeals judge Lisa Neubauer, who's backed by liberals.
The winner will serve a 10-year term, replacing Shirley Abramson, who's considered one of the court's liberal justices. Abramson chose not to seek re-election after more than 40 years on the bench.
WUWM's Marty Michelson caught up with both candidates on the campaign trail. We'll hear from Lisa Neubauer in a little while, but first, Marty talks with Brian Hagedorn, beginning with why he's in the race.
I'm running for the Wisconsin Supreme Court because I believe deeply in not having courts that engage in partisan politics. You know, my job as a judge is to say what the law is, not what I think the law should be. And that's what the rule of law means at the end of the day. It's upholding the Constitution as written and protecting the public. And I think it's incredibly important to have courts who know their lane, their constitutional role, and stay in that and do that well. And that will serve our whole civic culture in excellent ways.
What's the top reason voters should select you?
I think this race is really about judicial philosophy. And my opponent has upheld as a model the justice we're seeking to replace here, someone who has been far more political on the bench, who has brought her values to bear in her judicial philosophy. And I don't believe that's appropriate. I've been in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I've litigated many cases. I was a law clerk there. And I've seen what can happen when we have courts that have a more political orientation to the way they do judging, and I think it's wrong. It'd be wrong for people of whatever political stripe to do it. So we need judges who are there to do law and apply the law as written, and that's how we build confidence back up in our courts.
What's the top reason you believe voters shouldn't choose your opponent?
Well, again, I would go back to the issue of judicial philosophy, that I think her judicial philosophy in this situation is not appropriate for the bench. She's holding up as a model someone who's been political. The other thing I should say here in this race, we've seen significant attacks on people of faith in this race. And, you know, I think our constitutional rights are precious, rights like the freedom of speech and the freedom of religion. And I think my opponent has made clear in this race that she is not going to support and defend and uphold the rights of people to live out their own faith in their private lives as they see fit. That's foundational to our constitutional order. It's in our Constitution, so it's my obligation to uphold and defend all of our constitutional rights.
What's your judicial philosophy?
Well, my philosophy is I'm an originalist and a textualist. So I look at what the law is as written, which means I take my own views out of it. I don't ask, is this law fair? Is it not fair? I don't ask, who's the big guy or the little guy or who got the good end of the deal or the bad end of the deal? I look at the laws that are passed by the legislature. Doesn't matter whether it was Republican or Democratic passed law. You look at what's written. Same thing with the Constitution. You read it according to what its words meant at the time it was written, because that's what law is. It's based upon words written down that govern us, and my job is to say what those words are and not what I think the law should be.
If elected, what kind of cases do you think you would be asked to rule on in the next year or two?
Well, it's always tough to say. That's the most interesting thing about being a judge is you can sometimes never predict the types of things that are going to come before you. I do think moving forward, you're going to see clashes between the administrative state and you know, just the rule of law generally. There's a lot of ongoing conversation about that. I do think issues related to constitutional rights, like freedom of speech, freedom of religion, the right to bear arms, will be increasing flashpoints. And obviously, you know, we live in a time where we have divided government with different political branches controlled by different parties. That tends to produce political controversy, which oftentimes ends up in the courts. Hard to predict what those things will be, but that's why it's so faithful to not have anybody who picks one side or the other, but who's going to be faithful to the law. No matter who wrote it.
WUWM's Marty Michelson spoke with appeals judge Brian Hagedorn, one of two candidates on the ballot tomorrow in the race for state Supreme Court, and the candidate who is backed by conservatives.
Appeals judge Lisa Neubauer is the other candidate and is backed by liberals. Marty began her conversation with Neubauer with the same question, why she's in the race.
I am running because I am really fighting for a fair, impartial, independent court. What does that mean? It means that when people walk through our courthouse doors, they need to know that they will receive justice. No thumb on the scale, no ideology, no agenda, no predetermined outcomes. And that's the kind of judge I've been for over 11 years on the Court of Appeals, and that's the kind of justice I will continue to be if I'm honored to be elected by the people of our state on April 2nd.
What's the top reason voters should select you?
The top reason voters should select me is because I have far more experience and qualifications than my opponent. I have over 30 years in the law. I clerked for a federal judge before I started a very successful legal career for almost 19 years. I rose through the ranks. I made partner. I've had extensive experience in the courts. And now I've been on the Court of Appeals for 11 years. I have had, the opportunity in that role to literally decide thousands of cases. And I've been made chief by our Wisconsin Supreme Court twice. I've had a lot of leadership experience. I've had a lot of leadership opportunities. I've had a lot of experience to work with other people.
What's the top reason you believe voters shouldn't choose your opponent?
You know, the voters have a lot of information. The press has been very active in this campaign in putting out a lot of information about my opponent. He has been involved as a judge in starting a school that bans gay people, students and parents, teachers. He has aligned himself as a judge in giving speeches to a group labeled as a hate group, and many other things, writings on key constitutional issues. So the voters have a lot of information to consider in deciding who between us they trust will be fair, impartial, and independent.
What's your judicial philosophy?
My judicial philosophy is very straightforward. No agenda, no ideology, no predetermined outcomes. I approach every single case with an open mind, and my intent and what I believe I've done consistently for 11 years is to look at the law, follow the Constitution, figure out what the case presents. I look at every individual case as a separate, case with involving people. And I believe that is the approach that's reflected in my thousands of decisions.
If elected, what kind of cases do you think you would be asked to rule on in the next year or two?
Well, there's been, there's been articles in the paper about the kinds of cases that are going up to the Supreme Court, and that many of them they've accepted. I don't really have something to provide to your viewers on what I think that docket might look like. They typically take about 60 or 70 cases a year. Our court decides hundreds. So I'm just going to keep on keeping on, and I will come to every single case that's up there with an open mind.
Appeals Judge Lisa Neubauer spoke with WUWM's Marty Michelson. Neubauer faces Appeals Judge Brian Hagedorn at the polls tomorrow in the race for state Supreme Court.
In her interview, Neubauer mentioned that Hagedorn helped start a school, quote, that bans gay people, end quote. Hagedorn insists the school bans staff from being in gay relationships, but says it does not ban gay students or their parents. You can find more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break and then talk with architect Jim Shields and Marcus Center President Paul Matthews about their proposed changes to the site that would remove the Dan Kiley-designed grove of chestnut trees. You are listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues here on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. The fate of the proposed redesign of the Marcus Performing Arts Center is still undecided. The initial plan included removing the Dan Kiley-designed grove of chestnut trees, which is along the south side of the building.
Public reaction was swift and strongly opposed to the destruction of the grove, so much so that the Milwaukee's Historic Preservation Commission voted to give the entire site a temporary historic designation, which stopped any demolition or construction until final determination was made. The commission meets again today at 3 p.m. to determine whether the historic designation should be made permanent. If it votes yes, the Marcus Center would need permission to make any changes, including removing or altering the grove beyond basic maintenance.
In February, we spoke with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's former art and architecture critic, Mary Louise Schumacher, who argued that the architectural and historic significance of Kiley's Grove warranted keeping it as intact as possible. Today, we hear from Jim Shields, the lead architect on the project, and Paul Matthews, the president and CEO of the Marcus Center, who says the redesign was spurred by the center's growth.
We are changing as a performing arts center, and this is something that's been evolving over time. We are not just a performing arts center and just only focusing on what goes on in our stages. We're becoming a community gathering place. We are working very hard to be a performing arts center, a community performing arts center for the entire community. So several years ago, we started doing some research on doing a deeper dive into work we've been doing for 20 years on diversity, community engagement, inclusion, and so forth, with a local group, P3 Group, and they came up with some really good recommendations. And one of the things that they really stressed was that the building from the outside can seem rather foreboding and uninviting. And when people get there, they have a great experience. But they wanted to, they said, you've got to make this be a more welcoming, more visible, more open place. And we knew that we wanted to change it and make it, that, in that sense, our plan was mission-driven. We also needed to address the fact that we were a facility that relies over 85% on earned income, so we're looking for new ways to generate earned income. We wanted to, as part of our work as becoming a community gathering place, get a better use out of our building and grounds. Obviously, we're looking for ways to save dollars, operating dollars, as many nonprofits are. Then we turned to HGA and Jim Shields to translate that mission and that vision into reality, if you will, by putting this campus master plan together. Worked a lot with our resident groups, worked a lot with community groups that we collaborate with our board, and got a lot of input. And that's where we ended up with this long-term vision for the Marcus Center. And also just to say that it hadn't been really had a facelift, if you will, since the mid-90s. That was the last major renovation.
Jim, bringing you in on this from an architectural standpoint, this modernist, some people have called it brutalist building, is by its very nature, when it was built, kind of meant to be foreboding.
That's what brutalism meant. Yes.
Exactly. And so how do you work with that without destroying that initial concept, or do you worry about changing the initial idea of the building?
Well, for example, the main entry to the Harry Weiss building was entirely demolished in the mid-1990s, like 96. And then that curving black glass addition was put on, which is not by Weiss. And so I think a lot of people are actually under impression that that's a Harry Weiss building there when they come in the main entry. And all that is addition from 23 years ago. At the time, one of the best glasses they had to resist solar gain was the black glass. And unfortunately, it has some characters of that fortress-like foreboding character. And it's not original to the Weiss. And so one of the first reactions I had to Paul's request and their mission, which I'm very enthused about, by the way, was to reglaze that entire black glass facade in clear glass. Today we have coatings that reflect the sun's radiation but allow you to see in. It wasn't available just 23 years ago. So we can make this building visually accessible and transparent without affecting anything that Weiss did originally to the building, because that's all a very, very recent contemporary expansion.
One of the things I think that is so interesting about the discussion that all of this has provoked is how much do you pay homage to the history of it, the historic preservation part of it, and how much do you say, well, you know, we need to adapt this for our modern lives? Would it make sense architecturally to take it back to what Harry Weiss did originally, or is that not suitable for how we live now?
I think that it's probably not particularly feasible. You know, one thing a lot of people are not aware of, but some people will recall, about 20 years into its life, the Harry Weiss building started shedding its white marble cladding. They had clad the whole building in a white, very beautiful, snow-white Italian travertine marble. And unfortunately, 20 years in, pieces started falling off. It was put on only an inch thick. And at that time, the county made the decision that to safeguard the public, at the cost of multi-millions, they had to take all the white marble off, and they installed a buff limestone from our region here. And so, you know, at that point, the building lost all its original material. I think that's not widely known in the community. So, you know, there really isn't any original material that exists on the building at this time.
It's just the footprint.
The footprint. However, for example, the Harry Weiss building originally had three colonnades, one on the south facing the gardens, the entry colonnade facing east onto North Water, and the State Street colonnade. Now, at this point, two of the three have been lost. The north one was all filled in 20 years ago to create bathrooms and storage rooms. The east one was torn off for the new curving glass, black glass entry. And then the south one still exists, but all of its white travertine was torn off, and a granite base and a local limestone was added. So, you know, we've been surprised to have people suggest in the preservation community that it's still an extant historic building by Harry Weiss. By the normal criteria that brought to bear to identify a historic building, this one doesn't make it. And I sat on Milwaukee's Preservation Commission for 17 years.
And so we're looking at something that was once a Harry Weiss building and is no longer.
That's my opinion, and I think we got good evidence on that.
You know, and Bonnie, one image that you don't have in front of you, because there's much more that we're doing around the building, just to your point earlier about adapting the building. On the west side, which is on the Riverwalk side of the building, that's where First Stage performs in Todd Ware Theater. And they are tremendously successful, do wonderful theater for the entire family. They have said to us when we worked with them, we need a larger lobby. We need more space. And so as we looked at it, HGA came up with a very creative curvilinear atrium for that space so that they then could expand their lobby. But secondly, in addition to that, and this is not a fault of Harry Weiss, but when the building was built in 1969, ADA standards did not exist. Every renovation we've done since that time, since ADA came into the law, has been to make improvements in the building so that it's more accessible.
Well, we have to talk about the Grove, because that was probably the thing that received the biggest public pushback. Initially, the idea was to remove the Dan Kiley Grove. Is that still the case? What's happening with that part of it? Probably in some ways the most visible part of this.
That is the case. First of all, we start with the fact that our entire grounds is an integrated plan, and it's for that reason we had to look at the entire grounds. For example, we really have to address stormwater runoff issues. We have issues because we're right on the river. How do we change from a system that runoff just runs right into the river to now what we want to build, which is a filtered system, so that that water is filtered. It can then feed the trees, feed the grass, feed the plants. And we added bioswales around the outer edge of the grounds. Those serve a dual purpose, both in terms of what we're trying to do to reduce stormwater runoff and put cleaner water into the river, be good environmental stewards. But secondly, it serves a purpose about increasing security on the grounds, which was something that people didn't need to think about in 1969. So without being real specific, because we don't like to be too specific about security improvements, those bioswales do serve a dual purpose, and the grounds will be much more secure as a result of it.
In the rendering that I'm looking at, there are still trees there. So what's happening? Are those the chestnuts, or are they something else?
Those are honey locust trees. We did a lot of research as to the most appropriate tree, urban tree today, and we had to address a couple of other issues. I mentioned handicapped accessibility. That grove, which is about 30% of our grounds, again, not the fault of Dan Kiley, because the standards didn't exist, but it is not physically accessible and really can't be without removing those trees and having that ground be full surface so that people who are, anybody who's on the grounds, but particularly the people in wheelchairs, can see right at the Peck Pavilion stage, because we're removing that very ugly sound booth at the back
that,
of the
that
stage.
Barrier, that, yeah.
That barrier.
Yep.
And then ironically, what we found in our research, what our landscape architects and our arborists found in the research, was that there was a design flaw to begin with. Those trees were planted too close together to begin with. For the size of the tree, what you don't see above ground but below ground. The root balls are so huge. We're working with Dwayne Sturber from Woodward Forest Products, who's got a whole plan for repurposing all that wood. And it clearly is a problem. Those trees are not going to survive. We have four that have to come down now, and then another five next year, and after that, another most of the rest of the trees. They're rated from very poor to fair. And so we have a situation, ironically, where we're faced with this issue of historic preservation for the entire building and grounds because of an initial objection only over the tree grove. And the tree grove just cannot continue to exist. However, I would say that I think Jim did a great job of respecting the history because of the linear nature of which those rows of trees are planted. 16 very mature trees which have already been selected. They're a much better urban tree to allow shade and light on those grounds. So we think he did a good job of honoring the history of the grove and at the same time adapting it so we can get greater use for free community programming on the grounds.
Were you surprised at the community pushback about the trees?
No, I don't think so. I think we had discussed beforehand that removing the Kiley Grove was going to be very controversial. And, you know, I've been in the preservation community for a very long time and understand how passionate people are about preserving things. I think one of the challenges is that unlike a Cream City brick building in Milwaukee, trees, a grove of trees, they're a living thing. And they, I know people don't want to admit to themselves that these trees might be at the end of their life as a grove, but that really appears to be the case. And they're not going to live forever. And when we start, arborist, we have information that looks like 9 of them are in poor or very poor condition. That's 25% of the 36 existing trees. When the aesthetic of the grove is based on 36 identical trees, all the same species, all planted at the same time, at some point when those trees start to age out, something has to be done on the grove. You know, the Marcus Center 20 years ago contacted the Kiley office and said, what do we do when some of these trees start to die? And they said, well, you cut them. So it was a pretty simple recipe there. You know, we feel bad that the life of the grove probably has reached the end of its time span, but that really appears to be the case. Now, you know, the proposal that we have, Kiley has 4 rows of 9 for a total of 36 trees. We're proposing to, in the same holes, replant 18 of the trees, the 2 perimeter rows. So the mass of that grove will still be there. Kiley's green space will be replaced with a green space. There's no building construction going on there. We're simply trying to make the thing accessible, make the thing useful for the mission of the Marcus Center. You know, I used to be an usher there in the 1970s. been around Milwaukee a long time. And I knew the building so well as a young architecture student that I was the guy that helped the bomb squad search when they got bomb threats. So I know the building really well, and it's an advantage for renovation, let me tell you. And so I really care about the Marcus Center, and I'm really also really bought into what they're trying to do to bring the whole community together for affordable entertainment. And when we have an opportunity to build a part of a landscape that can work with the Peck Pavilion and have free performances out there for the public, a really broad variety of entertainment, I'm really with that mission. And if we can build a landscape that supports that so people could sit on a lawn and for free see and hear a performance, that's a really cool thing. And right now, you know, Marcus Center's worked for 49 years since I was a young usher there. And they found that the Grove has not been useful for performances. And 49 years, I think, turns out to be enough.
So where are you in the process of all of this? I know there have been a number of meetings with the Historic Preservation Committee in the city, and things kind of had to come to a halt while those proposals or objections were being considered. Where are you now?
Where we are now is on April 1st, there'll be the hearing on the permanent designation for the building. But what's still pending as well is that once you get a temporary designation, which they put on in February, you can't do anything to the exterior of the building or the grounds. And so we would need permission to remove the trees that are dead now. And our public hazard, based on advice from our attorney and our arborist and our insurance company, we have to have those trees removed if we're going to be able to continue with our summer programming this summer. At the very least, in order to program this summer, we've got to have those trees removed so we can get the cyclone fencing down.
One last question I want to throw into the mix here. I mean, since we made the appointment for you folks, you two, to come in to talk about this, we now have the 2020 Democratic National Convention in about 18 months' time. Are you hoping to have most of this done by then so people can, the 50,000 people who are going to descend on Milwaukee, when they're not at the Fiserv Forum, can maybe be taking in a performance?
Well, that's our plan. I will tell you, Bonnie, that within 15 minutes after the morning teas went out on Monday morning, we had our first call to book space in our building. We've been participating in those discussions about holding space available, but obviously the grounds would be a key part of that. And to the extent that there's an economic impact, there's a positive economic impact for us if the grounds are completed in time for that convention, because that will enable us to generate some additional income in addition to the free programming that we will have, which will still be going on, and we'll have to work around that schedule. But that is another great opportunity that we want to be able to, like any other venue or town or hotel or what have you, want to take advantage of.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how, you know, all of that plays out. And I'm hoping that once things are finalized and you know where things are, you'll come back and we'll talk about what the final plans look like and the timeline and all of that.
Absolutely. We would be glad to do that.
Great to come back.
Paul Matthews is the president and CEO of the Marcus Performing Arts Center. Jim Shields is design principal at HGA and the lead designer on the Marcus Center project. You can see a PDF of Shields' proposed design and hear Mary Louise's argument against destroying the Chestnut Grove at WUWM.com.
The Milwaukee Historic Preservation Commission is holding a public meeting today at 3 p.m. in City Hall to determine whether or not permanent historic status is granted.
We'll take one last break, and then cellist Robert Cohen joins us for another edition of On That Note. Stay tuned for more of Lake Effect here on 89.7 WUWM.
We are are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Every month, cellist Robert Cohen joins us to talk about the life of a working, touring professional musician. He's talked about concerts and venues, taking an instrument on the road, and teaching a new generation of cellists.
But today, Robert is thinking about politics, specifically Brexit, and what it might mean for both British musicians who tour in Europe and non-British musicians who want to perform in the UK. Robert is a native Londoner, and it's still his home base. He joins us via Skype and says the worry there has reached a fever pitch.
It's ongoing every second of the day now. We're at that point where every moment something changes, something happens, somebody says something. We think, you know, there's a kind of path going forward, whether we like it or not. And then 5 minutes later, it turns out, no, we're on a different path. We're going somewhere else. And then suddenly the same thing happens again. And it's that kind of point, even after 2 years, where, you know, reading the news is completely addictive. You just have to know what's going to happen next. And yet all of this is, well, if I can speak to for all musicians, maybe I shouldn't, but I think we all feel at this point that this is so much against what we stand for, what music stands for. You know, music is about collaboration, about being together, about making a voice together, about a language together, about inclusion, about, you know, love and about passion and beauty, and never thinking about whether it's anything to do with somebody from another country or from another part of the world with a different religion or a different sense of, you know, what life is about. We are just all a community because we make music, and what we see in front of us is incredibly disturbing because it represents a division. It represents putting up barriers. It represents, you know, separating ourselves from each other. And if I think of all the wonderful, incredible experiences in my life about working with musicians from within Europe, going back to, for instance, when I first played with the European Union Symphony Orchestra, I think it's, now it's kind of changed its name. It was called the European Chamber Symphony Orchestra. And this is made up of all the 28 countries, musicians from all the EU countries. And those experiences that I had when in my early 20s performing with them, and I know from my friends who were in the orchestra at that time, those were incredible experiences. They were, you know, to mix with all those people from all those European countries and create the most fantastic, exciting concerts. And those memories are very, very powerful and have actually forged collaborations and musical partnerships ever since that time. And just to think now that we could actually be excluded from that. I mean, we could actually, you know, not qualify to be part of that. I think that that's, I mean, not only is that tragic from our point of view, but it would be tragic from the Europeans' point of view as well.
The other thing that I'm thinking of is maybe even a little more practical, which is, if this happens, if Brexit happens, which it looks like it's going to, we just don't know what form it's going to be, the visa requirements change. All of a sudden, your passport is different, and the work, I'm sure they haven't even thought about, or they've gotten down into the weeds enough about this yet, but it could make it much more difficult for you to perform in Europe because you need some sort of special visa to do so, where you haven't had to have that before. And that has got to be weighing on your mind and other musicians' minds as well, as how are we going to be able to have our concert series?
Well, you know, I think I was reading an article by the Incorporated Society of Musicians, which was stating some extraordinary number of times that British musicians travel to Europe each year. You know, large numbers of British musicians go something like 20 times a year into Europe to do concerts. And sometimes that's just for one or two concerts, sometimes it's for a tour. But, you know, it's a normal thing that musicians are crossing the channel and touring in Europe. And the complications, I think, you know, we're in that lucky. I mean, Europe is small. I mean, you can drive around it, you know. You can cross borders so easily. And And the invitations that we have to perform around Europe, to a large extent, reliant on this, on that simplicity, on the fact that it's, you know, there aren't complications if you have to play in France and then in Belgium and then in Holland and then in Germany. It's very simple to organize that, and those events can happen easily. And yes, if you start to think that you might have to get visas, you know, because, you know, one concert's in France and one concert's in Belgium and they're 5 miles apart, and the complication of having to sort that out. Meantime, you've probably got to put your passport into the consulate or somewhere, and you're supposed to be traveling somewhere else. I mean, it could be an absolute nightmare. And of course, none of these things have been thought about. There's been no plan. You know, the people who wanted us to leave Europe were concerned more about people coming to work in the UK and people coming here as immigrants. And of course, they weren't thinking about the number of British people who travel abroad to work. And of course, for education as well, we have a serious, serious concern. As a professor at the Royal Academy of Music, I know that, you know, there's an enormous concern. There's something like 25% of the students that we have at the Royal Academy who are from Europe. And so many of our students go abroad easily to study in Europe and take advantage of different circumstances and environments and teachers that they want to go to. If that's going to cause a problem, I think for all universities in the UK, they are really worried that we're going to lose huge numbers of potential students, which of course means that our standards are going to go down rapidly because we don't get to choose whether those, you know, those people come or not, because they just won't be there. They won't be being offered to us. They won't be applying to us.
And again, I think of, as you say, that ease of being able to plan a concert tour, say, and not have to think about the visa requirements. I know for European musicians coming here, for any musicians outside of US coming here to perform, it's a huge visa hassle and it's very expensive. And
yeah,
I imagine
exactly
that the
and fear, if you think about a symphony orchestra that's traveled, I mean, the orchestra from the UK travel very often in Europe. And I, you know, if you've got 75 musicians or more who've got to all get their visas sorted out in order to do a concert or two or a tour, that's going to be, you know, extraordinarily complicated. But I think also what's very worrying is the kind of psychological, you know, the sense that maybe Europeans are going to say, well, why would we want to go and perform in the UK when they've got this attitude? I mean, they might jump to conclusions about, you know, what the English people think about the Europeans. After all, if you're going to separate yourself from the Europeans, what's your attitude to us if we come to give a concert? What's your attitude if we come to do something in education? They might be put off coming here just on the basis that, you know, it seems like they're not going to be welcome. And equally, we could say that, you know, here we are traveling abroad to play in Germany, and maybe they're going to think, well, why do they want to come here? Why should we invite them here if they've got that attitude that they don't want to have anything to do with us? So it's very emotionally stressful in that way, because, you know, who knows what people are going to think, what conclusions they jump to. I mean, I just hope that this isn't going to happen. I think let's hope that it goes the opposite way, that, you know, people say, well, you know, we understand this is the situation and we welcome that you're here. I mean, fortunately, I think that the music community will definitely try to counterbalance this, any bad attitudes that might be, but it's certainly concerning.
Yes, I imagine that it is. And, you know, you book out, what, a couple of years into the future, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so this has to have you looking at those concert dates already booked, thinking, am I going to actually be able to do those?
Well, I know at this point, if the, you know, literally right now at this moment, they're talking about considerable possibility of us crashing out without any sort of deal. That could cause unbelievable mayhem in terms of even just flights. Mm-hmm. How is it going to work? How, you know, because Europe controls and the supports, you know, the pathways and the air, you know, the organization. What is going to happen? Are we going to actually find this just so chaotic? But that's very frightening. It's hard to believe, honestly, Bonnie, that this is actually happening. You know, I think it's kind of soul destroying to think that Europe was put together in order to create peace and create harmony with these countries. And well, there are lots of bad things going on, aren't there? We know. I mean, not only is Brexit a considerably divisive thing, but also, you know, we've got governments in other parts of Europe that are causing dangerous things to happen as well. They could possibly be happening and breaking up Europe, and that could be a very bad thing. And here we are thinking, well, what are all the good things that Europe brings us? There are so many, so very many things, including peace and harmony. And I think that right now it's very hard for everybody. There's so much political argument going on. There's so much argument about, you know, you can sort of feel that the politicians are basically fighting for their own survival rather than for the good of the country. And that's very, very disturbing. And it's the first time in my life, having not lived through a world war, that, you know, I feel that we're actually almost preparing for a war and stockpiling medicines and worrying about, you know, all these kind of food and this kind of thing. This is, it's like preparation for a war. And that's most extraordinary and incredibly disturbing. And I'm sorry to be so down this episode, because normally we have so many positive things to say, and I do feel so positive about, you know, life and music, but this is really extraordinary.
Well, I don't even know how to wrap this one up, Robert, because it's such a huge topic.
It's like, yeah, I sit down with friends to talk about something completely different, and within 3 minutes, the rest of our conversation is dominated by this subject. We keep saying, okay, it's off the table. We are not going to talk about Brexit because we're all going to get so depressed. And within 2 minutes, we're back again talking about it because it is really overwhelming. We're desperately trying not to talk about it. As you say, it's never ending. Where does this discussion finish?
Right. Because even as we've said, even if whatever is determined, it's going to take decades to sort out. So it is this like never ending thing off into the future. Well, the way I want to wrap it up, despite all of that, you're still making music.
Yes.
And you're still making music with friends in Europe and in the United States. You're about to come to the U.S. for a tour. We're thrilled to have you back, even though, you know, you didn't make it back to Milwaukee this time. But I'm hoping that the next time you actually do have a concert here, we'll be able to do something for Lake Effect. And so I take great hope in every individual musician who's out doing exactly what you're doing, despite all of it, and all of the artists and everyday people who are just trying to make it better one day at a time. So I think that's how I'm going to take away from this, is that you're going to continue to make wonderful music, and we will continue to talk about it.
Absolutely. And thank you for saying that, Bonnie, because it really helps.
Any little thing I can do, have a cup of tea, Robert. Isn't that the great British answer to everything? Let's have a cup of tea.
Yeah, well, let's do that together soon.
I would love to. And next time we will hopefully have a slightly more. But I think this is a really important conversation to have, because it's how politics and world events are affecting individuals. And, you know, and that's what we can do here on radio, is to kind of shine a little light on that. So thank you for being so honest about it. I know it's really a tough thing.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to all the people who are listening to hear me in this kind of very negative state. But, you know, let's hope for the best now.
Yeah. Yes. And like I said, continue to make wonderful music.
Indeed. Thank you, Bonnie.
All right, Robert. We will talk next month.
Absolutely. Look forward to that, Bonnie.
Professional cellist Robert Cohen joins us each month to talk about the life of a professional musician in a segment we call On That Note.
We have some time left on today's show, and given our conversation with Robert, we thought the best way to fill it was with some of his music. In this 2017 recording from our performance studio, Robert is joined by his former fine arts quartet colleague, violist Juan Miguel Hernandez. They performed Beethoven's Duo for Viola and Cello, which is also known as the Eyeglasses Duo.
Thank you.
Our 2017 recording of Beethoven's Eyeglasses Duo for cello and viola was performed for us by cellist and contributor Robert Cohen and violist Juan Miguel Hernandez. Jason Reavy engineered that recording session, and the piece wraps up today's show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next, and it's 11 o'clock.